Good morning, everyone. My name is Nick Gregory, and I'm founder and CEO of the Wealth Engineering family of companies. And I'll be hosting today's teleconference, which is part of our teleconference series. Now, before we get started, a few comments. We've all been hit by an unforeseen, uncontrollable, catastrophic event. This financial seismic shift demands a wealth management seismic shift. It is a bold new world, and we must adapt, and we must move forward with a new mindset. In a sea of sameness, how do advisors brand, position, and differentiate themselves? It isn't just going virtual. If we only change the media without changing our AUM/product offering mentality, we will not progress. How do advisors evolve from checkers to chess? Advisors can transform into a new wealth management dimension. Firms can rejuvenate the contours of their practices to become more agile. Advisors can fuse new services, products, and wealth tech with sound engineering principles. Why don't firms better sync their practice ecosystems with the wealth ecosystems of their clients? Why don't advisors evolve their centers of gravity from AUM/product provider to holistic fee-based solutions provider? Why not add new ingredients to your mixing bowl and expand your choices of options while maintaining flex and balance within your firm, such as utilizing creative tax engineering? So with all that said, we'll be taking a Reader's Digest approach to a very expansive topic today, creative tax engineering in uncertain times. Our special guest today is Howard Nieswander. Howard is a JD and an LLM, as well as a certified financial planner, a trust and estate practitioner, a certified exit planning advisor, and he is shareholder of Cerotti and Permute, a national law firm located up in, with their national headquarters located in Birmingham, Alabama, which is a member of our expert sourcing consortium. Now, we'll be taking an interview approach, so let me start out by asking you, Howard, your background along with the global high net worth capabilities of Cerotti and Permute.
Well, thank you, Nick. It's great to be here with you this morning. My background is a little bit unusual. I practiced law in Alabama for several years and then decided to get out of the practice of law and actually got into the financial services arena. I got together with a couple of guys and we formed our own national wealth advisory firm and had our own RIA and worked with very high net worth families pretty much all over the country. And so I really got a real taste for working with high net worth families through that. We were kind of a virtual family office. We provided all types of planning, investment, and soft services for our clients pretty much all over the country. And we even had a couple of international clients that we worked with. So I did that for several years and then got, convinced I needed to get back in the practice of law. So I moved back to Birmingham, Alabama, and I have been with Cerotti now since 2012. And we are a kind of a boutique, large boutique firm. We're over 150 attorneys here in the state of Alabama. We specialize in working with closely held business owners and high net worth families all over the country. And by being based here in Birmingham, it just gives us a great quality of life, but also the ability to reach out and, you know, deal with folks in Chicago, New York, LA, all the other major areas, providing great services and, very high level work. So we're very happy to be in a position to do that and are very grateful to be on the call today.
Well, great. And don't you have, 28 other LLMs on staff at Cerotti, including yourself?
We do. We probably have got one of the largest tax benches in the country. We have 28, I think it's going to be actually 30 when we have our new attorneys join us this summer. So we'll have 30 LLMs, most all of us from New York University, the top LLM school in the country, at least we all think so. And so we are very, very heavily involved in the tax area. And that's just so important now, because I think we can all agree that going forward, no matter if you're a blue or a red state, taxes are going to have to go up to help pay for these subsidies that we've been providing through the coronavirus pandemic. So we're all just going to be very interested in every planning idea we can possibly think of, because we know that taxes are going to have to go up to help pay for these deficits that we're running right now.
Yeah, the tax techies in Washington are going to have fun creating an even thornier thicket of taxation, aren't they?
No doubt about it.
Can you touch on your relationship globally? I'm sorry, your relationship globally with your firm, with Legal Alliance?
Yeah, we are part of an alliance with other law firms around the country, actually around the world. There's several that are in foreign countries. So this gives us not only the ability to handle matters, obviously, within the Southeast, but we can also, obviously, as I mentioned, do things more on a national and global platform. So people always ask me, well, are you licensed in 50 states? And I certainly am not. But what I am able to do is use one of our alliance partners that is in virtually every state to assist me. So I can work from Maine all the way through the Midwest out to California without any issues, because we always have a local partner there to join up with and to make sure that we're meeting any local legal requirements that might be involved in the matter.
Okay, so it creates a very fluid environment. Domestically and globally. That's great.
Absolutely. So we can pretty much handle anything that comes down the pipe, no matter where it's located. So these days, through the miracle of technology, we can pretty much service a client anywhere on the globe.
That's powerful. Very powerful. So from a creative tax planning standpoint, what thoughts might you have?
Well, there's kind of a hodgepodge of things I thought I would talk about today, just because there's just so many great ideas out there. One thing I would like to mention to the audience is that if you're dealing with closely held businesses, particularly ones that are going to be transitioning, now would be a great time to do an installment sale. Right now, the applicable federal rate that's issued by the Internal Revenue Service is at the lowest rate it's ever been in history. Right now, it's 0.58% for a 9-year installment note. So now would be an absolute fantastic time to look at doing an installment sale, perhaps internally to next generation, maybe the senior generation transitions the business down to the next generation. Maybe the senior generation looks at selling to an outside third party, and maybe there's something like a deferred sales trust that might be applicable. That's just simply a strategy where you can take in the proceeds from the sale and stretch it out on the installment sales basis, perhaps even just doing an interest-only note for 15 or 20 years and let the rest of the funds work for your benefit instead of taking a haircut. So that's a very, very powerful tool that we're using.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, can you give us an example or two regarding how that's worked in specific situations in the past?
Yeah, I'll give you one I'm working on right now. There's a client of mine that is basically tired of, the rat race, so to speak. He's built up his business. He's got a third-party buyer out there that's willing to pay him a large sum of cash. He's got very little basis in his business because he started it many years ago and, built it up. So if he took that cash, he would basically be hammered with capital gains tax. So what we've done is we've set up a deferred sales trust for him where he sells it to the trust in exchange for an installment note. And then the trust turns around and sells it to the third party buyer and gets the cash proceeds. So my client is only going to get taxed as he pulls money out of the trust, and he doesn't really need the money right now. So he's going to pull out that minimum amount of interest, that 0.58% I mentioned to you, and the rest of it's going to be available to be completely invested in marketable securities, real estate, anything else he wishes without the capital gains tax haircut he otherwise would have taken.
And who has control over the cash that's sitting in that trust?
Well, the trustee does, but what we've done is we've created an investment advisor. So the trustee has delegated those investment advisory functions to his own investment advisor. So he's got his financial advisor just like he would have if he had taken the funds outright and paid the capital gains tax, investing all the funds for him. So he's not really lost any control at all from an investment standpoint.
And he's eliminated the risk of the buyer getting into financial difficulty if it were just a straight transaction, deferred installment sale, where suddenly if the buyer gets in trouble, everybody's in trouble, right?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. So you've got the security of knowing that your funds are right there. And if my client ever wants to take money out of the trust, then he just basically accelerates payments on the note, which he has every right to do. So it's a win-win all the way around.
And how many business owners are very frustrated with where they are right now, relevant to we're getting a lot of calls relevant to situations such as this, where they're just ready to cash in the chips. This unforeseen catastrophic event has really soured them.
I think we're going to see a
first generation.
I think we're going to see a huge number of these situations arise just because most people in their, let's just say, their late 50s, early 60s. Thought that they had another 5 to 10 years on the horizon. But I think the pandemic has really forced them to reconsider. I think a lot of them are now thinking that, I'd much rather sell out now rather than have to work in this business, for several more years. So I think a lot of people are going to be making some life-changing decisions. And I think this is going to accelerate mergers and acquisitions going forward.
Very material, whereby 12 months ago, I believe the AFR was at 1.6 or 1.5, and now we're looking at 58 basis points. That's just amazing. And that's amazing how that changes the numbers substantially over a period of time.
It can really mean the difference between a good sell and a great sell. So now is an opportune time to consider this and not let this opportunity slip away.
Interesting. Other ideas or concepts, Howard?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them out there. I tell you one that to me is a great one that a lot of people I think are steering away from, but is going to be huge going forward, and that is a captive insurance company. Captives, I think, have gotten some bad press here recently, and people think that they're really targeted by the IRS. But if you do it right, it is a huge tax planning tool, as well as just a godsend from an insurance standpoint. What people are going to need to understand is because of this pandemic, commercial insurance does not cover the virus. All of our clients are going to find out that their business interruption insurance has gotten the option for the virus, and they may be suing their insurance company or maybe trying other routes, but it's going to be very hard for them to get coverage. And the insurance companies, the ones that actually are you know, going to take a hit are going to look at, you know, higher deductibles, higher retention rates, and higher premiums. So one way to avoid all of this and to get the kind of coverage that you need going forward is to create your own captive insurance company. You can have your captive actually provide business interruption insurance that's covered with the virus. And that is a huge, huge benefit. That insurance is probably not going to be available anywhere that you can, you know, find. And you can basically have it with your very own captive. So we think that going forward, captive insurance companies are going to be really, really things that people need to look at because we just don't know when the next virus is going to happen or if we're going to have a second wave or anything like that. So this could really mean the difference between a business surviving and thriving versus not making it if they've got the ability to cover business interruption through their captive and covering the virus scenario.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you relevant to, first of all, commercial insurance. The deductibles and co-insurance limits are going to be elevated, so that creates automatic self-insurance for so many commercial businesses. And then once we get past the stigma of captive insurance company, because there's been a lot of bad press, and there certainly are captive management firms that have done things very, very incorrectly. And they're being, the IRS is dealing with that currently. So we've got to get past the stigma, but it's a very powerful tool, a very complex tool. With your experience in that over the years, Howard, it really opens up a great opportunity for all the advisors that we work with, both CPA firms, other law firms, and wealth management firms to head your direction in discussing this in more detail. Way of the
future. Absolutely. And, you know, we've had tremendous success with the ones that we've done in the past, and we see nothing but, smooth sailing going forward. If you do it right, like you say, you've got to make sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's.
The manipulation has occurred in this captive insurance company arena, that's for sure. So we're, you know, some of that's being sifted out as we speak. But yes, it's from a standpoint of adding new ingredients to the mixing bowl and working with specialists like you, relevant to our expert sourcing consortium, advisors can take advantage of programs like this and make sure and know that their things are going to get done right. And now that they brand position, differentiate themselves with their clients. All right. So captives and deferred sales. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, what the Trump tax law did a few years ago was create a section called 199A that provides certain benefits to small businesses, pass-through businesses primarily, businesses that are in subchapter S corporations or limited liability companies, partnerships, even sole proprietorships. The only problem is that there's typically a income amount that once you're over that, you don't get the benefit of these 199A tax reductions. So what we've done here over the last couple of years is we've helped our clients set up trust funds for their children, move some of their ownership into those trust funds, and then that way, everybody basically qualifies for this 199A benefit. And to avoid the high trust rates, as you well know, the trusts get into the highest income tax rate after just a very small amount of income, about $13,000 worth of income. We've made these trusts what we call Section 678 trusts. And that's just a fancy word for a trust that's taxed to the beneficiary and not to the trust itself. So if we have two or three trusts that are owning interest in this business to create these Section 199 benefits, then each child is taxed on the income rather than the trust. And that gets us a significant amount of tax savings, not only through the 199A benefits, but also the fact that we're not paying these high trust rates. So 199A planning, I think, is something that people fail to really consider. They think that, well, I'm over the income limits, there's not much I can do. Well, you know, creating trust and moving interest into those trusts is not very complicated. And if you've got children that you're going to be basically providing for anyway, it's a great way to get funds to them on a very tax effective basis. And I think that's even more, going to be the case because a lot of my clients have had children, particularly in the service industry, like restaurants and things like that, that have lost their jobs. And this would be a great way to provide some support for them, again, on a very tax effective basis.
And odds are good that a 12-year-old's tax bracket might be lower than the patriarch of the family, huh?
Absolutely. So it's a great way to shift the income. And if you're going to be, again, using that income to provide for your children anyway, then it's a lot better to have it taxed at their bracket than taxed at mom and dad's bracket and then them having to turn around and gift it to a child. So it's just a win-win all the way around for the family.
Yeah, very effective. And it's amazing to me that we'll be working with a family and their other advisors, including legal counsel and or the trust. And in a lot of situations, the advisors and the family involved don't know that the max tax bracket kicks in after $13,250 currently.
Yes,
they're not even aware. There's silence on the phone when we bring it up. They don't we're at max tax bracket immediately after $13,250, whatever it is. So ignorance is a blissful thing. And then take that and use it to our advantage relevant to and creating using the tools that Congress has created over many, many years. How do we assemble those tools and zero in with the client's specific needs, concerns, and objectives in coordination with their other advisors and do this kind of planning? Pretty powerful stuff.
Absolutely.
All right, so installment sales, captives, 199A/Section 678,
there's a couple of other things I'll just mention real quickly about the 678 trust. Actually take an existing trust out there that's currently paying those high income taxes after $13,000 worth of income and convert that to a 678 trust. Even though it's an irrevocable trust, these days we can go in and convert that to a 678 trust and create some significant income tax savings. So just because it's a old and cold irrevocable trust being taxed at the very high rates doesn't mean it can't be changed over to a 678 trust. And then secondly, we're also doing a lot of changing over from the old conduit trust on the retirement plan side to accumulation trusts that are 678 trusts. As you know, with the new SECURE Act, you know, there's 10 years of deferral, and basically at the end of 10 years, you have to have it come out of the retirement plan. You can't do the stretch like you used to do with children and grandchildren. So we're creating a lot of accumulation trust to hold those proceeds at the end of 10 years for asset protection purposes, but then using a 678 trust to avoid the high income tax rates that otherwise would be there. So it's just kind of a really cool way of using that 678 in a couple of different ways from that standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the old and cold irrevocable trusts out there that there might be certain advisors and families thinking they're all locked up. They're planted in concrete, and the concrete is locked. You know, they can't move. And with your creativity, things can be adjusted so they're not locked up.
Exactly. I mean, there's no such thing as something we can't change these days. So we can make it better. We can make it much more tax efficient. We can do pretty much anything that needs to be done to make it a much more productive tool.
Okay. Fantastic.
There's something else I wanted to mention to you, too, or mention to the audience, and this is something I think that people really don't think about it, but it's a very cool tool, and that's what's called a Section 139 Employee Relief Plan. One of the things that's happened through this coronavirus pandemic is that Congress has come out and declared this to be a natural disaster. You know, they've done that in the past for hurricanes and other natural events, but this is probably the first time, at least in our lifetime, that they've done it with a virus like this. But what this allows an employer to do is to create a plan for the employees where the employer can make distributions to the employees to help reimburse them for some of the expenses that they've incurred because of the pandemic. The employer gets a tax deduction for the distribution, but the employee does not have to pick it up as income. So it is a much better tool than bonusing money out to the employee or anything like that, because now you get a win-win. You get the employer with a deduction on its side, and the employee doesn't have to pick it up as income on his or her side. So these are things that people don't really think about. We haven't had to. But I think this could be a very important tool for that employer that really would like to do something for its employees, and this would be an outstanding way to really create some great employee morale in these kind of murky times.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we have a national disaster as opposed to being localized like a hurricane in Florida. So it opens up all 50 states, correct?
That is correct.
And with the employer, if it's not considered income, he's eliminated Social Security on those same dollars. He's not paying its tax deduction. And then the employee is receiving dollars in their hands without having to pay tax or Social Security tax. Everybody wins. Kind of similar to, and I think you're going to bring up educational funding. The limitation to the 5250, but similar to a dependent care program, if set up properly.
Now, what limitations
may exist with the Section 29? What dollar amounts? What limitations may exist there?
Well, I think you just mentioned it's 5250, if I'm not mistaken. You're talking about the educational plan?
Yeah. No, the Section 139. I'm sorry, I'm bringing you back. Yeah.
The limitations are typically you have to set up an independent panel to process claims. And what most employers do is they have primarily employees on that panel, so that they can make decisions for the people that. Produce, a claim, and you really don't have to have any real documentation about that. So if you put forth a claim that you've had expenses that, have been directly caused by the pandemic, then the employer could reimburse you up to a certain amount. Most of the time they put a dollar cap on it, and that could be whatever the employer felt appropriate. But you just have to do it in a non-discriminatory manner. So that's why you need an independent panel such as, a group of employees to make these kinds of decisions for the employer.
Mm-hmm. So you're creating a committee. And a 501c3 is required in this equation, isn't it?
You don't necessarily have to have one. You can use a 501c3 if you want to create a charitable deduction, if you want to get other people to contribute. But if it's just the employer wanting to use its own funds, then you don't even have to have a 501c3 involved. You could just do it under the Section 139, just on the employer side.
Okay. Well, great. Great. Good clarification there, because my son and I founded a nonprofit organization 5 years ago as a 501c3. And we, in addition to working with other nonprofits on a national basis and a lot of fundraising, providing them with various fundraising capabilities and planned giving capabilities. We have what we call a Give at Work program, which fits in well here if you're looking at, in addition, in a separate, setting aside that the employer is going to make the entire contribution into the fund so that a 501c3 isn't necessary. But what if other employees want to assist in addition to the employer, and then you're controlling that element with a committee or a group overseeing it anyway. But our 501c3 is also set up to private label donor advised funds for and private income trust, which is a pooled income fund environment for wealth management firms and accounting firms. But I digress a little bit relevant too, but it gets my mind thinking about how quiet, how seldom does 139 get brought up of the code?
Almost never. Yeah, you're exactly right.
It's just very quiet. And there's so much sitting around. Congress has created a lot of tools that successful American families and businesses can take advantage of. And so often that there's ignorance is a blissful thing relevant to advisors, whether they be law firms, accounting firms, financial advisors, and so on. And it, this stuff sitting around, and how might it fit, or a combination of the tools to help families and businesses change the characteristic of a dollar by utilizing these tools and setting that dollar in a different place, and how that dollar can then be utilized in such an efficient way instead of just being totally exposed to flowing into a 1040 or 1120 and the IRS getting a max share of that. Anyway, I digress. So
no, that's great. And in fact, it kind of leads me to one last thing that I'll mention. And this is one that I think people don't really pay enough attention to, and that's an employee stock ownership plan or an ESOP. And the reason I bring that up, Nick, is that I'm seeing situations where the patriarch and matriarch are wanting to sell their business. The children aren't really interested. They either don't have the capability of running it, or they don't want to work as hard as mom and dad have had to work in the business. Mom and dad thought they had a nice suitor out there, a third-party buyer, but because of the pandemic, the buyer is out of the picture, and then they're just sitting there floundering. Well, an ESOP would be an outstanding way of getting some liquidity to mom and dad on a very, very tax-effective basis, and it's really a win-win, because a lot of times, if you don't have, a family member that's willing to take over the business, if you can't find an outside third-party buyer, then an ESOP is pretty much your only choice versus just shutting the doors, and it can be an outstanding opportunity for the family to be able to cash in their chips. And then the employees can basically take it over and run it, and everybody comes out a winner in that scenario.
It's amazing how seldom used an ESOP is. There are only, 7,000 or 8,000 ESOPs in the country. And there are millions of small business owners. And I'm totally baffled by why it's seldom used. Of course, it has to be done right. There's a million ways to mess up ESOP management, to evaluate or not improper valuation or just maintaining it and so on. And it gets some interesting bad press on occasion, but it can be a very powerful tool. And of course, you have to have a team assembled to make sure it gets done right, not just day one, but 20 years from now. And it's
exactly,
if you will, similar to a captive insurance company. There's a million ways to mess that up, and it's got to be maintained. And of course,
absolutely
simple teams.
But just like you say, if you get a good team, if you get a good attorney, a good accountant, a good valuation firm, and then a good administrator, then it is just an amazing what kind of results you can achieve. We've done multiple ESOPs and have a couple in the hopper right now. And they are just, I think, a perfect solution to where we stand right now, because we just don't know how quickly these third-party buyers are going to come back, if they're going to come back at all. And a lot of times, even if they're interested, they want to have such, you know, stringent payment terms. They want to have such due diligence and things that, you know, sometimes a small business just can't overcome some of their requirements. And so an ESOP is a great alternative. But like you say, people just don't think about it because they think it's very complicated, very expensive, and only for the larger businesses. And we could, you know, say that's exactly the opposite. I mean, it can be a very, very valuable tool for even a mom and pop shop, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah. I got involved in my first ESOP back in 1987, so I can certainly identify with what you're relating to. But back then, it was very hard to assemble that team, if you will, when we were working with many members of the National Tooling and Machining Association back then when I was in private practice up in the Cleveland-Akron area, if you will. All right, so we talked about installment sales and captives and Section 678. Trusts and Section 139. We touched just briefly on the educational. I think that's Section 127. Being able to pay off loans up to $5,250 for an employee, in addition to always having that ability to be able to make tuition payments for employees through an educational assistance program, which I think is well kept secret as well. And then you last touched on ESOPs. And again, a very complex animal, if you will. There are a lot of moving parts, but it can be so powerful. Any final thoughts before we open it up to question and answer, Howard?
I guess
comments?
There's just one last little quick thing I'll mention. This is in the CARES Act, but a lot of people, I think, have missed it. And that is a lot of our clients, Nick, I think, are going to have to be making some leasehold improvements to their property to maintain social distancing and to add protective equipment and things like that. And there is a provision in the CARES Act that allows them to write off 100% of that this year. So as long as they're not doing anything to a load-bearing, wall, they can basically go in and make all these improvements that they may have to make from the coronavirus standpoint and write off 100% of that versus having to take that out over a longer period of time. And I don't think people are really focusing on that because they just haven't really thought their way through the fact that there are going to be a lot of our clients needing to make these kinds of improvements.
So the installment shields and so on. Now, is there a limitation to that? And it is a pure deduction, right, as opposed to a credit?
It's a pure deduction, and they could spend, you know, a $10,000 or a $100,000. As long as it's, again, not on a load-bearing wall, then it's not a problem. All they have to do is just make the improvements, and they can write them off 100%.
So no dollar limitation. Huh.
Correct.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff, relevant too. And again, when we're talking to business owners and families, you know, how do we brand position, differentiate ourselves? Do we sit there and talk about, gee, I can beat your current advisor by 50 basis points on your liquid investment dollars? Or do we talk about things like this? Do we talk about what are your needs, concerns, and objectives? How do we might we accomplish the concerns that you have or satisfy your today's objectives, both for you and the matriarch and the patriarch of the family or business and your children moving way into the future? So this is pretty powerful stuff. So, Howard, won't we open it up to Q&A now? Adam, can you unmute everyone? And
all guests have been unmuted.
What questions or thoughts might you all have? Yes.
Hey, Bill Newton here.
Hey, Bill.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
good. Got a couple questions. Okay, a couple questions for Howard. Howard, I know you talked about captives and people shying away from them. What are your thoughts on conservation easements? Are they fall in the same category?
It just so happens that we have the largest conservation easement practice in the country defending these. And what I would say is, if you're in a conservation easement that's not your own property, there's probably a 75% or greater risk of getting audited. We're happy to defend you, but it's very expensive, very time consuming, and the IRS is not backing down on any of these. They're taking them all the way to court on virtually every one of them and not settling. So I would be very hesitant to get into one, unfortunately. We think that they're, you know, obviously great from a tax benefit standpoint, but the risk of getting audited right now is unfortunately pretty high. Like I say, we're defending these all over the country, and people are unfortunately having to spend a lot of money to defend them.
The ones we're in right now, of course, the company has set aside up to, you know, a whatever dollar amount they have to defend the lawsuit. But so are you defending the conservation easement fund itself, or are you defending the individual person?
Typically what happens is that the IRS will come after everyone. They'll come after the entity, and they'll come after all the participants in the entity. So we typically are representing everyone because everyone's interests are aligned. And, you know, you just hope that there's enough funds that have been reserved to cover the cost. But like I say, it gets to be very expensive because they're not settling these, and we're having to try virtually all of them. And that gets to be very, very expensive from a legal standpoint.
Are there legitimate ones out there where the or let me ask you this question. What are you seeing in reference to the appraised value or the multiples that could pass muster versus the ones that are being defeated?
Honestly, we're seeing that it doesn't really matter, that the IRS is so opposed to these that it doesn't really matter from a multiple standpoint. There is really no magic number. There's no, guidelines here, no bar or anything like that. Again, unless you're dealing with your own property, it's unfortunately going to be in the sights of the IRS, and you're just playing audit roulette if you're in one of these syndicated deals.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Interesting sponsors of conservation easement programs out there, and we look at it as a huge red flag. And of course, advisors can get in, I'm sure, you know, with a platform you're working with, Bill, is sound. But
based on what Howard says, is whether or not it's sound or not, whether or not they, you know, their appraisals are conservative, it seems it doesn't matter.
Yeah, they're going to chase it. And similar to some of the things that the IRS has done with 419E of the code and 412I, and, you know, there's a history of how these type platforms that have been sponsored by firms going back years. Once the IRS gets, once the attention of the IRS gets with one of these programs, then we could be in trouble. So it's interesting that Howard's, he's working on the other side of that equation, isn't he?
Yeah.
How to protect instead of how to take advantage of a huge tax deduction, when you get through paying the penalties and interest on the other side, it may take all the fun out of that exciting, those exciting tax deduction, those credits and deductions up front. So anyway,
are the penalties severe, Howard?
What they're trying to do is come after you with everything that they've got. So there could be underreporting penalties. They've mm-hmm. even talked about, and I don't know if they're going to get to this point or not, even criminal penalties. So they just floated that out there to kind of put the fear of God into everyone. And but they're on record saying that they're even looking at criminal penalties on some of this stuff.
Thank you.
So substantial penalties, interest, underpayment, and then you have the legal fees. Because if the IRS isn't going to back off, that can get very expensive. That becomes a substantial tax, doesn't it? The legal IRS.
It does. Absolutely.
Probably can't handle that for free. Any other questions, thoughts, comments relevant to the
group? I got a question. Can you hear me?
All right. Yes.
Okay. On the 678 trust for the conduit on retirement plans, Howard, could you speak to three different stages of how to document this? One would be prior to death, but you have it set up at death during that 10-year period. Then after the 10-year period, so I'm looking at these three stages as it impacts structuring 678.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, the 678 trust, of course, is just the beneficiary of the retirement plan, typically the contingent beneficiary, because if you've got a spouse, you typically want to do the rollover, as you well know. So it's either going to be the contingent beneficiary, or if it's after the first death, the direct beneficiary. But yeah, what happens is the retirement plan, you typically want to let it accumulate over those 10 years and just take out, you know, whatever required minimum distributions. Well, actually, during the 10 years, you actually don't even have to have the required minimum distribution. So let it just grow during that period of time. And then at the end of the 10 years, what happens is the funds then come out of the retirement plan into the 678 trust. You pay taxes at the individual beneficiaries' rates, but now they're inside of a trust. They're protected against divorces and creditors and bankruptcies and all that kind of good stuff. And then it's just like any other trust. It just continues for their benefit, but it's taxed at their individual rates versus the trust rate.
Okay, so the tax situation at the end of 10 years will be the full amount of the trust?
Well, it's not going to be any different. Let's say that I just had the child be the direct beneficiary. At the end of 10 years, it's going to have to come out of the retirement plan. We know that because we can't do the stretch out any longer. And the child's going to pay the tax, and now the money is going to be subjected to creditors and bankruptcies and all those kinds of things. So the income tax is the same versus an outright distribution to a child versus in trust. But now the fact that it's in trust, you've got the asset protection benefits that a lot of our clients really want. Now, a lot of our clients don't want to see their retirement benefits go to their child's ex-spouse or something like that, or to get sued and have a loss there. So again, it's the same tax situation in that scenario, but you're adding the asset protection benefits that we're all looking for.
How about during that 10-year period, are taxes being paid at all?
No, because if the funds stay in the retirement plan, there are no taxes being paid, because obviously it's compounding on a tax-free basis. If you pull funds out during the 10 years, then you've got to pay income tax on them then. But what most people are saying, and I think this makes the most sense, leave them in the retirement plan as long as you can to get that tax-free compounding. And then when you pull them out, you're still going to be much more ahead than you would be if you took it out, say, 10% a year over 10 years.
Thank you.
Ken, the two of you may want to talk offline as well if you want to expound into the complexities, if you will. So anyway, any other questions or thoughts before we conclude? All right, so In conclusion, for those who don't already know, my organization provides coaching, training, marketing, and case design in coordination with our portfolio of advanced strategy platforms that focus on the entire family and business wealth ecosystem on a fee basis. My organization and our expert sourcing team consult with over 2,100 wealth management and accounting firms, as well as broker-dealers and multifamily offices on a national basis. Through our open option practice engineering sandbox, we help wealth advisors fortify their value proposition by fusing new services, products, and wealth tech into their firms, creating fresh revenue and profit silos while enhancing client acquisition and retention, all while leveraging against unforeseen, uncontrollable, catastrophic events. Sound familiar? Now, as a reminder, our Spring Wealth Advisory Conference has been merged into our Fall Conference, taking place in Tampa Bay, September 30th through October 2nd. Howard and the rest of our expert sourcing team will be presenting there, and you can learn more about the conference at our main website, the address is thefisinfred.com. So with all that said, I hope you've gained more insight into how you can utilize our firm in coordination with Howard and Cerruti and Permuth and the rest of our expert sourcing consortium to gain more success and control within the high net worth and business advisory arena. Now, to contact and access Howard and Cerruti and Permuth up in Birmingham, Howard's direct line is 205-930-3929. 205-930-5329. His email address is HNEISWENDER@Cerruti.com. And of course, the website for Cerruti and Permuth is Cerruti.com. And again, his email address is HNEISWENDER@Cerruti.com. And of course, our main website address is the short one is thefisinfred.com. My email address is nickg@thefei.com. And our direct phone line is 407-878-3520. Howard, you have any final comments before we sign off?
I think the only thing I can just reemphasize, Nick, is that we all know that no matter what happens election-wise in November, taxes are going to go up. So I hope everybody takes these concepts to heart and gets creative with their clients and tries to provide the value, because tax savings just goes straight to the bottom line, and it's a great return on the investment.
Yeah, as opposed to a client making $1 million this year and it all flows in on a absolute income tax basis into their 1040 bucket, and we do nothing to assist in reducing that tax or dealing with long-term or short-term capital gain with their businesses and so on. So shame on us if we're not adding new ingredients to our mixing bowl to brand position and differentiate ourselves with our clients, particularly our business owner clients and our larger families, if you will. So with all that said, thank you again, Howard, for participating today. Thank you for all attendees for participating. Again, please feel free to contact Howard directly with more specific questions. And I wish you all a great rest of your day, whether you're on the East Coast, West Coast, or sitting in the middle. Thank you very much.